Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
Oh, what's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again.
Well, Dr. Craig, it has happened, and we anticipated it in some past podcasts. We speculated that perhaps the Supreme Court would be making this marriage ruling and that it would fundamentally change our society. A couple of disclaimers. First of all, we don't pretend to be legal scholars. We want to look at the ruling and look at what the justices said, evaluate it from a philosophical and theological standpoint. And in a couple of weeks from now, after we look at the initial ruling, I'd like to hear from you on where we go from here. What's next? What does this mean? How should we prepare for this enormous ruling? You have made a few statements. Now that we're in the podcast, Bill, what are some personal reflections on this?
Well, I think it's tremendously tragic and also misconceived, Kevin. I think it's tragic because it fiddles with a cultural institution that even the majority of the justices recognize lies at the very foundations of not only American culture, but they say of human civilization itself. And they have redefined this fundamental institution in such a way as to deny really that it has any essence. It is now whatever five unelected lawyers on the Supreme Court declare it to be. But I also think it's terribly misconceived because when I look at the decision and I look at the arguments they give for thinking that two men can marry each other or two women can marry each other, these arguments to me don't seem to hold water. And so I think it's both unfortunate and quite mistaken, the decision that the court has made.
Well, it's got social ramifications, but what about for our democracy, our way of governing ourselves?
Yes, this was, I think, the primary concern of the dissenting justices. Their dissents in this case are just excoriating of the majority. I've never read dissents that are filled with the degree of sarcasm and ridicule even of the majority. Scalia says in his dissent that even if he could be in the majority by being a fifth vote on this, he would be embarrassed to be part of an opinion that is so poorly written and so much a departure from the great opinions that justices have written in the past. They think that this opinion is one that, in the words of Scalia, he says, this court has made a decision which threatens American democracy. Those are incredible words. But the dissenters think that what has happened is that they have removed the decision from the people to these five lawyers, and that's their term. They don't call themselves five justices. They say five lawyers from Harvard and Yale on the Supreme Court, unelected by the people, have now made a decision to fundamentally alter American democracy. And Alito, Scalia, Roberts, they're all very concerned about what this says for American democracy.
The dissenters pointed out that one of the principles that the majority of the court ignored, this principle of restraint when it comes to the court.
Yes,
rather than being adventurous and trying to change society, that's not their job.
Yes, that is very interesting. Alito points this out. He says that the court itself has criteria for when they can find implicit rights in the Constitution as opposed to explicit rights, such as those that are delineated in the Bill of Rights, where you have the right to bear arms, you have the free exercise of religion, there's freedom of speech. Those are explicit rights. But for the court to say, well, here is an implied right that's not delineated, but it's hidden in there somehow, As Alito says, the court itself has said that these rights have to be deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. And he says it is beyond dispute that the right of two men to marry each other, for example, is not deeply rooted in American history and tradition. It's a radical departure from it. So that the court has thrown restraint to the winds and read this implicit right into the Constitution that the framers of the Constitution would have been astonished at. And so much of the dissent concerns this constitutional question. Has the court correctly read the Constitution and exercised a sort of judicial restraint that the court says it should in finding implicit rights?
Many have said that it was also very hasty of the court to make this ruling, and that American culture was trying to come to terms with this new world. And how do we handle same-sex relationships?
Yes, there's no doubt about that, Kevin, that there has been a huge shift in American public opinion about this, partly because of earlier court decisions striking down state laws and amendments and referenda that said that marriage is between a man and a woman, essentially. And so public opinion has been changing. And I think some of the justices thought that this process should have been allowed to run its course and let the American public come to a decision on this. People like Roberts and Scalia, in their dissent, said, we don't have any brief to carry for traditional definitions of marriage, but this ought to be left to the states to decide, and this process has been aborted by this Supreme Court decision, which, again, failed to let the democratic process run its course.
There are people who are more open today to the idea of civil unions, but not to redefine marriage.
And I think it's important to understand, Kevin, that that really is what the court has done here. Some folks think, well, they've not really done anything radical here. They have simply allowed people of the same sex to enjoy the benefits of marriage that people of the opposite sex have been able to. What's the big deal? And I think what these folks don't understand is that what the court has done is to redefine marriage. And Kennedy recognizes this in the majority opinion. Referring to the traditional view, he says that in the traditional view, marriage is by its nature a gender differentiated union of man and woman. Now, those words are important, by its nature. Kennedy recognizes there that on the traditional view, it belongs to the essence of marriage that it is a heterosexual union. And he says this view is now obsolete and needs to be done away with. So they are overt that they are changing the essence of marriage. They are changing the nature of marriage and redefining it. And in fact, now, as I said earlier, what they've done is they've deconstructed marriage so that it no longer has a nature or essence, but can be whatever five lawyers on the Supreme Court determine it to be. They have deconstructed marriage so that now it can be whatever anyone, well, or whatever the people in power, I should say, want to make it.
Greg Kokel said something along the lines of, marriage is not defined, marriage is discovered. It's one of those things where the definition is literally discovered rather than just randomly defined. Kind of like truth. Truth is not determined, truth is discovered.
Yes, I agree
and marriage
with that,
is so,
Kevin. And for that reason, I think that this isn't, in a sense, even an issue that the states should have the right to determine. I don't think that the states have the right to define marriage. But that seems to be the view of the minority of the court, that constitutionally the regulation of marriage is not a federal issue, it's a state issue. And that was why the Supreme Court earlier declared unconstitutional the Defense of Marriage Act, which had been passed by the United States Congress and signed by President Clinton into law. It was now federal law that marriage is inherently a man-woman union. And the court struck this down. Why? Not because they said same-sex marriage is implied in the Constitution. but because this is a states' rights issue. The states have the right to regulate marriage, not the federal government. And therefore, this congressional law and presidential signature was unconstitutional. They threw it back into the laps of the states. But then, in a sort of catch-22, when the states try to support the traditional view by passing amendments and referenda that say marriage is a man-woman relationship, then the court turns around and declares those unconstitutional because they have found this implicit right to same-sex marriage in the Constitution of the United States. So they put the states, or the American people, in an impossible situation. It's a real power play by the majority of liberal justices on the court, what they've done here.
And it's too late now for the states to do anything. I mean, the states can't do anything. This is the law of the land.
The only thing that could happen now would be for the court to reverse itself, that in the future some more conservative justices might be appointed and this might be revisited and reversed. But the experience with Roe v. Wade and the whole abortion rights issue, Kevin, shows how unlikely such an eventuality is.
Or at least how long it would take.
Yeah.
Because there's move away from Roe v. Wade, but how long has that taken?
Well, and it's not enough. I mean, it hasn't made a difference on the Supreme Court. It's still 5-4 in support of abortion on demand in this country. And this decision now follows, again, 5-4 in the steps of Roe versus Wade in reading implicit rights into the Constitution that aren't really there. And in a sense, this decision is the echo or the reverberation of Roe versus Wade that legalized abortion on demand in this country, because it's very much the same sort of decision, taking the decision power away from the people in the states and investing it in five lawyers on the Supreme Court to read hidden rights into the Constitution that the minority justices would say are purely imaginary.
Bill, you said something earlier about how fast public opinion has changed, breathtakingly fast, over a period of 5, 6, 10 years, just almost a reversal by public opinion. You said that it was due to some of the court cases. Do you think it's because the law is a great teacher?
I do think that when the court makes a decision, that does influence public opinion. If the court had upheld things like Referendum 8 in California or these state laws in Oklahoma and elsewhere, declaring that marriage is inherently a man-woman union, that would have affected public opinion, I think, in quite the opposite way. But when the court continually strikes these down, I do think that that tends to shape public opinion so that it begins to change. Now, obviously, there's a lot more influences here culturally, the influence of Hollywood, the entertainment industry, activists for same-sex marriage, but the decisions of the court shouldn't be underestimated in their ability to change public opinion. And I think this one will do this as well.
The majority opinion, they said the ancient origins of marriage confirm its centrality, but it has not stood in isolation from developments in law and society. The history of marriage is one of both continuity and change. That institution, even as confined to opposite sex relations, has evolved over time. For example, marriage was once viewed as an arrangement by the couple's parents based on political, religious, and financial concerns. But by the time of the nation's founding, it was understood to be a voluntary contract between a man and a woman. Then they go into the old doctrine of coverture. A married man and woman were treated by the state as a single, male-dominated legal society. Where they're going with this, Bill, it seems, is that even though marriage is very central, as they say, a human institution, and very, very ancient, one of the most central in human history, that it has not been impervious to change. And that brings up things like multiple wife marriage, you know, in the Old Testament, and arranged marriages and things like that. And so they say, well, then why not just change it again?
Yeah, this is their rationale. They recognize that they are changing or redefining the essence of marriage. in doing this. And part of the rationale they give is to say that marriage has changed over the years. And they give these examples like the ones you've mentioned. Well, in the past, parents often arranged the marriage of their children. And so if that can change, why can't we change marriage to no longer be a heterosexual union? And I think this argument is difficult to take seriously. These other ways in which marriage have changed have been not the essence of marriage. They've been trivial, contingent properties of marriage. And in fact, in some parts of the world, like in India, when I visited there, I found, talking to folks, parents still do arrange the marriages of their children in India. But the essence of marriage is the same. It is essentially a man-woman relationship, even if parents might be more involved in India than they are, say, here in the United States. So I find this almost disingenuous on the part of the court to think that these kinds of trivial changes would justify saying that it no longer belongs to the essence or nature of marriage to be a heterosexual union.
The court seemed to acknowledge that protecting marriage, the right to marry, is that it safeguards children and families and thus draws meaning from related rights of childbearing, procreation, and education. He seemed to have heard the arguments that, look, children do better, according to research, in a man-woman relationship, a mother and a father. The ideal and the research still shows that the best place for a child is in a male-female, mother-father relationship. And this denies a child that arrangement through adoption, things like that. That child who's adopted into the family may be adopted into a loving gay couple, but it certainly falls short of where research shows a child best flourishes.
Yes, that's right, Kevin. And I was really shocked when I read the four reasons that the court gave for allowing a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. The third one of these was, as you mentioned, that marriage safeguards children and family. And this is so ironic because it is precisely because of that marriage needs to be preserved as a man-woman relationship. Mark Regnerus, the professor at University of Texas, Austin, has done the most extensive research in the lives of children raised by same-sex couples. And as you say, the research shows that these children are significantly disadvantaged educationally, socially, and in other ways. And you remember, Kevin, we did a podcast some weeks back by a young woman who is promoting the rights of children and saying that children should not be disadvantaged by being placed in these same-sex arrangements and thereby denied the right to a mother and a father. And this has been a whole new movement now that has arisen among adult children of same-sex couples.
They say don't do it.
Their rights have been abridged by this. So far from justifying same-sex marriage, this third reason that the court gives is one that provides very strong grounds for preserving traditional marriage.
It's as if, the heck with the children, my romantic notions take precedence
over them. Yes, the children have been sacrificed on the altar of the satisfaction of the adults' desires.
Fourth and finally, this court's cases and the nation's traditions make clear that marriage is a keystone of our social order. Marriage is the foundation of the family and of society, without which there would be neither civilization nor progress. So they're making a nod toward marriage, but then saying, but we're not going to hold to the traditional.
Yeah, these reasons are bizarre, aren't they? The fourth reason is that marriage is a keystone of our social order. It's absolutely fundamental to society. And therefore, two men should be able to be married to each other, or two women should be able to be married to each other. It seems a non sequitur to me. It's certainly true that in our American society, married couples enjoy benefits that singles do not have. For example, filing income taxes. You can file jointly as opposed to separately, which single people can't do, right? But does that provide a rationale then for saying, well, two men can be married to each other? Well, no, not at all. It it doesn't follow any more than, well, three people could then enjoy the benefits of marriage by filing jointly their income taxes. You just wonder when you read this, how could the court have seriously thought that these reasons justify same-sex marriage?
Yeah, and I read one commentator who said that the court's ruling on paper sounded like a seventh grader's Facebook page post to her friends. I mean, just flowery, and I'm looking at it, what does it have to do with the Constitution? This is very philosophical. A lot of philosophy in this, in social engineering.
Yeah, oh, it is social engineering. I totally agree. They have turned marriage into a purely conventional arrangement that is defined by the majority justices of the Supreme Court, which, of course, changes over time. So it's purely conventional. And you can look at this decision from two angles, Kevin. There, you can look at it from the constitutional angle and say, have they provided convincing arguments that there is an implicit constitutional right to same-sex marriage? Or you can look at this opinion from a philosophical standpoint and say, have they given good philosophical arguments for denying that it belongs to the essence of marriage to be heterosexual? And I'm very skeptical that they have satisfied the constitutional issue, though, as you say, we're not legal scholars. But with regard to the philosophical question, I think these reasons are fanciful, that these would supposedly justify redefining marriage to remove heterosexuality from its essence.
By the way, no disrespect to seventh graders. I know some very smart seventh graders, but it was very flowery, almost like a post that you'll read somewhere on a social media that is very flowery and romanticized. As we wrap up the podcast today, this is the nod to America's religious opposition to same-sex marriage when you read this paragraph saying, finally, it must be emphasized that religions and those who adhere to religious doctrines may continue to advocate with utmost sincere conviction that by divine precepts, same-sex marriage should not be condoned. The First Amendment ensures that religious organizations and persons are given proper protection as they seek to teach the principles that are so fulfilling and so central to their lives and faiths, and to their own deep aspirations to continue the family structure as they have long revered. The same is true for those who oppose same-sex marriage for other reasons. So there seems to be here at least a nod in the direction of those who are opposed to redefining marriage.
Yes, they're trying here to quiet concerns that religious liberty will be infringed by redefining marriage in the way that they have. And the reason that fear is real, I think, is because marriage is not a private institution. It's a public civil institution. And so if you are a wedding photographer who doesn't believe in same-sex marriage, and a same-sex couple comes in and says, I want you to take photos of our wedding ceremony, and you find this repulsive and immoral, nevertheless, the law requires you to go and take those photographs because marriage is a civil institution and you must obey the law with respect to that regardless of your private opinions. And many of the justices were concerned with how this is going to shake itself out in American society in trampling upon the rights of those who disagree with same-sex marriage for philosophical or religious reasons. And this is going to play itself out now over the next several years, and it will be very interesting to see what happens. Will military chaplains, for example, have to perform same-sex wedding ceremonies among military members, things of that sort?
Well, we are out of time, but we will pick it up right there with Dr. Craig on our next podcast. So many of you, I know, see the importance of what we're talking about and the importance of these next several podcasts that we're going to be doing on this topic. please go to reasonablefaith.org, and not only can you get more information and commentary on this topic from Dr. Craig, including in the question and answer section, but you can also partner with us. You can donate and keep these podcasts spreading all over the world. If you believe in this message, please support us. Your financial and prayer support is such a blessing, and you can click on donate when you go to reasonablefaith.org. I'm Kevin Harris. We'll continue this topic next time with Dr. Craig on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.
Will a man shall leave his mother and a woman leave her home? They shall travel on to where the two shall be as one, as it was in the beginning.